And that's the kicking music that means it's time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. And I'm here around the table, still without Trey Graham, who is still on vacation, but with the rest of the Pop Culture Happy Hour crew. Stephen Thompson, what do you do for NPR?
Well, I'm a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do for NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
And back behind the microphone this week to help us out is our esteemed producer, Mike Katz, of who we have dragged from his usual duties and given him those duties, as well as additional new duties.
That's right.
So how do you feel about that, Mike Katz?
Pretty good.
Pretty good. You're just slowly taking over that microphone.
Yeah.
I like to think of Mike as a giant, many-tentacled octopus of competence and production.
Huh. Excellent, excellent. And as some of you may know, you'll be hearing this on Friday, but today is Tuesday, and our day here at NPR was interrupted briefly by a medium-sized earthquake.
Yay!
And Will Smith.
And also Will Smith.
Yeah.
So you should just know that it's earthquake day as we tape this. We've all survived.
I survived the mild tremors of, yeah.
That's right. We've all survived. I like to think we're all thriving.
Our eyes are shallow and listless.
Right.
And we're just shells of our former
Exactly. Exactly. And, of course, we've spent the day being made fun of by people who live in California who don't know why we're such babies
sure.
that we even care that our building.
Shut up.
Seriously, if you live on the West Coast, cram it.
Right. Yeah.
Our buildings do not shake all the time.
Exactly.
Actually, I want some people in New York to cram it because on Twitter they were all like, ooh, New York City earthquake. It's like, no.
No, it wasn't. Because you felt it doesn't mean it was yours.
It wasn't even ours.
News hogs.
It was Richmond, Virginia.
It's true. It's absolutely true. Anyway, but, I just wanted to set the stage for this podcast and just let you all know that it is the earthquake podcast. So if we are more shaky than usual,
fragile,
if our voices are going, that's why.
If I stop and ask Mike to hold me.
Right, exactly.
That's
that
not
will
that
be
different than normal. Every show.
Right, actually. That'll be part of why, at least. So the first thing we were going to talk about this week, this actually was an idea that came up on our Facebook page. We had spoken a few weeks ago about summer movies and summer movie trailers, and we had mentioned the trailer for Rise of the Planet of the Apes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And we had talked about the fact that the trailer was, to me, pretty funny. So we were encouraged to put ourselves through the exercise of actually going to see Rise of the Planet
rather
of the Apes,
than just mocking it out of hand.
Sure.
Shocking to find out whether did we feel that our initial reactions were accurate.
In light of the fact that it got some great reviews. It got largely positive reviews.
It did.
And is a big hit.
Uh-huh. And it's a big hit. So we all went, I assume. Uh-huh. Everyone did the homework.
We did.
And went to see Rise?
The Rise of the Planet that will become the Planet of the Apes.
I actually wrote down the dawn of the birth of the origin of what will one day result in the rise of how our planet will become the Planet of the Apes. Because that is what happens in this movie.
See, mine was off the cuff. You planned out that joke way earlier than I did.
Your joke is studied. It's true. Stephen, what did you think of the movie?
As my totally off-the-cuff jape would suggest, I just thought it was unbelievably slow, particularly the first hour and 10 minutes. Now, I happened to see this movie at the side of when Linda Holmes, and you and I kind of both did the, when are they going to rise?
Yeah.
Rise, apes!
They rose. This is a really slow rising apes, as they would say in the baking industry.
The fireworks factory argument,
which has
been espoused in this podcast many, many times.
Yeah.
It was an awful lot of, like, then the ape wore pants.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of, like, getting the ape to wear pants before you got to the point where the apes, rise.
Right.
I was sort of amazed at how few action set pieces there were in what is ostensibly a big ape movie where apes are supposed to go all ape.
Right.
Were we rooting for the apes to actually rise?
I was. I just wanted them to rise. I wanted the apes to rise.
Because you wanted them to win, or you just wanted something to happen?
Well, that's what I mean.
Well,
I mean,
if it's a prequel to the Planet of the Apes, presumably the planet is going to eventually be overrun by apes.
But here's the problem.
You just want to root for a winner. Go ahead.
I'm a front runner.
The problem is you're rooting either for A, the abused apes to kill humanity.
Right.
Or humans to continue to abuse apes.
Well, that's the thing. And I felt like it was, oh, okay, this is not an apes run amok movie. This is a bioethics lesson. it certainly has some sort of interesting things to say about, like, once you sort of break the seal on, experimenting on these animals, you get to the point, blah, blah, blah. But all this stuff with, like, James Franco's dad, like, there, you know, I mean, we can certainly get into the sort of the endless run of these movies that have daddy issues at the core of them. But, man, I just wanted the apes to rise after a while. Just to have the ape, you know, smash things and throw people. And
by the time this movie ended, I had enough holy crap moments for it to save me. I mean, there were some holy crap moments there at the end. And as I was talking to a friend of the show, Chris Klemek, about this, who liked this movie, I think, a little bit more than I did, the ending set piece makes sense. They have a simple objective to get across the bridge. They use the natural San Francisco fog to help their case. That set piece was great. It's really simple and laid out. Now, things that I was sensitive to in the trailer, which I really hated, things like James Franco turning to the camera and saying, "We call it the cure." That, if you noticed, they changed that. They used a different take. So that scene became a part of a pitch to the board where he says, instead, "We call it the cure for Alzheimer's." Small change, but that took a lot of the stuff I was kind of I wanted it to be campier. I wanted it to be sillier.
It is not a silly movie.
And they were playing it pretty straight.
Yeah.
The originals don't play it campy too much. At least the first two, they take themselves very seriously. To us, they look campy and they are campy, but they took themselves pretty freaking seriously in those initial movies.
Yeah. The thing that this film has been getting dinged on a lot is that you can feel the PG-13 radiating from it.
The what the cut.
Yeah, but also, I mean, when those apes rise, you want them you want to see some blood, and you don't see it. And, I thought that was the film should have gone farther, but, the guy I saw it with, my partner, was like, no, I like the fact that that puts the apes at a higher moral ground and that they don't kill and they hold back. I don't know. I think I would have gotten some more yayas out of this thing.
You wanted Frida Pinto's face eaten?
I didn't want Frida Pinto's face touched.
She was the only one to root for in this movie.
That's true, but she has nothing to do in it.
Like, she has nothing to do, but ultimately that's why she's an okay person.
She has so little to do with
either
this
side
mess.
Is a pretty terrible option. So.
Right, yeah. Because James Franco not only causes the apes to rise, but also wipes out humanity. Yeah. I mean, so like, in response, that's a lot of weight to put on James Franco's empty suit. Empty white coat.
It's true. And I have to say, it's really funny to me that you talked about how they had the simple objective going over the bridge to get to the forest, because I didn't necessarily catch that was the end point to get to the forest, because of the way they were rampaging. It never occurred to me, like, they want to go live peacefully in the forest. I was
it's like the Duke boys crossing the state line.
Yeah, I saw it as more of like that they were on some kind of rampage because of the way that it was being shot and everything. Mm-hmm. And so I was like sitting there watching them on the bridge, like, what are they trying to do? Like, they don't want to kill people, so what are they doing? And I said to Stephen afterwards, I was like, I was sitting there being like, are they trying to get to the airport? It's my fault. I mean, I had forgotten the whole set piece with the Muir Woods and all that stuff.
Right.
And I still feel somewhat dubious about the idea that the chimps were going to go live happily ever after as a race of super smart apes in the trees of Muir Woods. Mm-hmm. So I still kind of don't understand that whole deal. I didn't understand what their objective was or what they were trying to accomplish. I felt like they were just mad. You know what I mean? I just felt like they got out and were mad. As I understood it, Mike, you were even less of a fan of this movie.
Man, I've seen every single Planet of the Apes movie. I really love the first one, but I've seen even the bad ones, and even the bad ones, I feel like, were somehow more plausible. And when you think about the origin that they presented in those original ones, where, so nerdy, but they go back in time and they give birth to another baby chimp, and that baby chimp eventually leads the revolution. That somehow made more sense to me than and that third one was the Terminator meets Star Trek, where they go back in time to 1973 to save money on their budget because they only have to pay for 3 monkey costumes.
And then the spinoff where they meet the Jetsons.
Yeah. More or less.
Well, Mike, we don't know where his mom came from, where Caesar's mom came from. She could have come back in time. They might be doing a Star Trek thing here where they're not disavowing.
It wasn't Cornelius and Zira.
Well, we could have been Zira. They called her Bright Eyes. It could have been Zira for all we know. Who knows where Cornelius is?
You're stretching.
No, I'm just saying.
You're stretching the retcon.
Just saying. Now, Mike, what did you think of Linda's point about the tag? She wrote a great blog post on Monday about the fact that humanity gets wiped out after the credits. What'd you think about that?
I actually stayed throughout the rest of the credits to wait for like another tag. I didn't think like that initial tag, which came pretty much at the very beginning of the credits, was it. Throughout the credits, they were showing like that computer animated sort of map
of
like the spread of the virus. I was expecting them to kind of like do like a little tease at the end of the aftermath and like tease another movie that would actually show.
Well, it
the
seemed,
hellscape.
It seemed like an incomplete prequel, that's for sure.
Well, right. And it just felt to me like all the business about the virus and everything, it was too big an element in the movie to be pushed off on this little tag where that was the only point when it became relevant.
If we know what point B is, mm-hmm. does it matter that we see it? We've seen that movie a million times
right.
where you see, you know, the outbreak of the thing. Hell, there's a movie coming out soon that is that outbreak, that
right.
Soderbergh
Contagion.
Movie. Where, yeah,
right.
it's coming. We've seen that movie so many times.
See
we've seen
one.
Walking Dead. We've seen Dawn of the Dead.
Right.
It doesn't bother me totally to see how humanity is going to act when all of a sudden it's the end of the world.
To see them take a shortcut to the end of the world.
Yeah, I liked the economy of that. I really dug it. Because I think the film you're asking for there, Linda, is not Rise of the Planet of the Apes, but the fall of the planet of us guys. And I don't want to see that movie.
No, I'm not necessarily saying that. What I'm saying is, if you're going to include that, you have to serve that story a little bit better. But I think part of this comes down to when you're making Rise of the Planet of the Apes and it's whatever Planet of the Apes movie that there has been, how much you have a right to treat it only as, from the beginning, a piece of a bigger franchise that's mm-hmm. only going to be satisfying and make sense if you've seen the other ones. And, I mean, I had somebody in the blog say, you know, you're not very bright because you don't understand that it's a setup for a sequel. And I was like, no, I do.
Yeah.
I do. I get what they're doing. But when I go to a movie, it still needs to stand on its own. And I personally don't watch Planet of the Apes movies other than this one. So maybe I come at it from an angle that they would basically say is irrelevant. Like the number of people who will come to this movie without caring about the rest of the Planet of the Apes franchise is small enough that they don't really care what I think. Mm-hmm. But to me, it just felt like the only way to rescue it is to really, really analyze it only as, you know, relates to the other ones.
Right.
Well, they're so hemmed in by the mythology of the series. I mean, they
well, it was treating it pretty much as a reboot, though. I kind of disagree with that. I mean, it was basically, I think, treating it as like a complete reimagination of what happened.
But if you don't know that about Planet of the Apes, if you don't know that the point is that eventually the apes are going to be in charge of the whole planet, if you take it as a reboot and it only goes as far as it goes, that's when I think the virus part seems really tacked on and weird.
Right.
Like, you get there and you're like, oh, okay, so the end of the movie is the apes get away and, you know, are going to go live in the woods. But then why did they have this tag where humanity gets wiped out by a super virus? What is that about?
These movies sort of have a history of, like, these tag sort of things. And I feel like they were trying to force one in there. It seems like maybe the last chunk of that movie was probably rewritten to have some semblance of like a happy ending, at least with like the couple characters that we know.
Yeah.
Because
we'll eventually
when it's
contract
right,
a horrible virus
well,
and die.
But it's right there in the title. You know what's coming.
Right.
And so like the mystery is sort of gone. Yes.
This is why instead of this, if they wanted to make an awesome ape movie, they should have just spun off the PlayStation game Ape Escape.
Mm-hmm. You know, actually humanity doesn't get wiped out technically. As
they're
you,
enslaved.
As you, yeah, they become mute and partial to loincloths. Two things I am both in favor of.
Especially in the case of James Franco.
In the case of James Franco. The genocidal, by the way. Let's not lose sight of that. The genocidal James Franco.
Yeah.
Well, he doesn't mean to.
He didn't
genocidal.
Mean to. He was doing it. He missed his dad.
Oh. He wanted to help his sick dad in scenes that stretched on for a very long time.
How could you tell that John Lithgow was losing it? Hair.
Right. Well, the other thing that Stephen and I thought was really funny coming out of that movie is that neighbor is like the most unlucky dude like ever. First, he has the chimp come into his backyard and like attack his
job is
his
to be
yard.
Pummeled by a chimpanzee.
Then he has the old man randomly show up in his car, which leads to having the crap beaten out of him by a chimp.
Mm-hmm.
And then he gets in an unrelated event.
Yes.
He gets sneezed on by the guy from Reaper. And
there are days and there are days.
Exactly. And that guy is like the most unlucky. He is a very unlucky man.
Yep.
They live next door to the unluckiest man in America. So it didn't work for you, Mike, as a Planet of the Apes guy?
I told Steven this earlier this week, but it reminded me of that Patton Oswalt bit about going back in time to kill George Lucas.
Yes.
And in that, he goes back and he says, you know, I'm working on these prequels. Do you like Darth Vader? He's like, yes, of course. He's like, well, you get to see him as a little kid.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want a dish of ice cream? And he says, I would love one. He's like, well, here's some rock salt and go make it yourself. And basically his point is, I don't care where the stuff I love comes from. I just love the stuff. And ultimately, I feel like I've seen that origin so many times, whether it's a superhero movie or an action movie or whatever, mm-hmm. taking the mystery out of it defangs the entire thing.
So to speak.
Yeah. That scene on the beach, that classic scene, basically says it all. You know?
Right.
Yeah.
He says, you did it. We did it to ourselves, blah, blah, blah. So
you blew it up.
Right. I mean,
in the original Ape films, there was a big part of it about it being post-apocalyptic, post-nuclear, right?
Well, yeah, but that was also the era of the 1960s. Sure. And so, like, mm-hmm. they kind of built into that. Now we sort of have, it's sort of the era of designer drugs and chemical warfare and bio-warfare and things like that. So it makes sense that in our tinkering with the genome and to try to make, like, these cures, it's very possible we'll create a superbug. And I feel like that's sort of our nuclear weapon of the time. And so right. it makes sense.
The tone of it and kind of a lot of the corny acting and some of the other stuff that was happening only works for me if you think of it kind of like a B-movie, like a big-budget B-movie.
Yeah.
But for me, if you're going to be a B-movie, you have to move a little faster. It's got to be more entertaining than those long sequences at the beginning that are like, you know, now he's going to put on pants and now he's going to learn how to eat and now he's... And all the long stuff with the father and just...
The
it
first,
felt
hour,
to me
the first
like
hour
it's
and 10 minutes of that movie yeah. are excruciatingly slow.
It's too slow to be a B-movie.
To be honest, though, I've watched a lot of B-movies. Yeah. They are really slow and...
They can be pretty boring. I agree. There was too much ape, emo, mopey... Mape looking at you with wounded eyes yeah. kind of thing.
And to call back a little bit to something I said in the blog post that I wrote about this movie, it was to me too much Project Nim, not enough Project X.
Part of the problem is like you're sitting there holding your, you know, your armrest with Project Nim or like, the, you know, these horror stories of people's faces getting ripped off. And so mm-hmm. even from the very beginning where he takes the baby chimp home, you're like, that can't be a good idea. These are right. wild animals that they're trying to tame and treat right. like babies and right. humans. And
right.
those scenes where like it escapes and like wanders through the neighborhood, like what do they expect?
Right.
Yeah.
You know?
the whole movie is basically way to go, dummy.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it kind of is. And then it's like, well, does it turn out to be a good idea or a bad idea to try out your experimental drug on a human? Actually, it turns out to be kind of a bad idea. Does it turn out to be a good idea or a bad idea to not wear your gas mask while you're administering gas?
I felt bad for that guy.
Yeah, he's had a rough go. Is it a good idea or a bad idea, you know, to abuse apes with an electric cattle prod when they weigh a gazillion pounds and you don't have the, you know, sense God gave gravel to keep them
away from the water hose?
Yeah, away from the water hose. So I don't know. It ultimately didn't work for me, which I thought was weird because I know a lot of other people like it, and I'm certainly open to liking that kind of movie.
I'm clearly the target demographic. I've seen so many of these, even the horrible ones, even the horrible cartoons. Mm. And I know that they're dumb, but I should have liked this more.
Because one of my other friends who has seen all the Planet of the Apes movies said that it was the second best one.
Hmm. One thing it's going to do because of the long, slow ramp-up is it's going to quash any impulse on my part to see it again because it just takes
right.
so
right.
long.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I don't want to see a sequel because I thought, you know, we got everything we needed with the... I would have cut after we see him that he's a pilot. Boom, done. That's all we need.
Frida Pinto, though.
Frida Pinto.
Pretty hot.
Nothing to do, but very beautiful.
That's the story of my life.
could not have less to do with herself, but... Boy, she's nice to look at.
Yep.
She needs some better roles, too, I think.
Call me.
So the other thing we're going to talk about this week is sort of ripped from the headlines, as Steven says, of his own personal life. Why don't you explain?
God.
You know, it's not going to be as cringe-inducing, speaking of cringe-inducingness, as...
This
as
is not therapy, by the way.
This is not, no. And it seems like such a natural segue. Speaking of incredibly slow, we're going to talk about insomnia. Not the film. Another idea ripped straight from our Facebook following, and
right.
we would certainly encourage everybody to go to facebook.com/PCHH.
And be part of the editorial process.
That's right.
And be shocked at how much of how much input you actually have into this show.
That's right. Be shocked at your ability to pull the strings and make us dance.
That's right. Ripped from the headlines of my personal life and my complete inability to sleep. We figured that that my own malady would be an excellent opportunity for us to talk about ways that popular culture allows us to sleep more easily. Not in terms of hardy har har, this is so boring, it let me sleep.
Right.
But what do you turn to, somewhat of a variation on pop culture comfort food, which mm-hmm. we've talked about on the show in the past. If you're actually looking to fall asleep,
what do you do?
And I'll throw this out to the group. When you cannot sleep, do you turn to your television?
I do not tend to turn to television. I tend to turn to things I've already seen. I am a watch DVDs at night when I'm trying to fall asleep person. And I, as I mentioned on Twitter, I had a very tough night the other night because I fell asleep watching The Big Bang Theory on DVD. And when that happens, all night it plays that Bare Naked Ladies theme song over and over and over and over and over and over and over all night. And I kept waking up. I wasn't awake enough to care enough to roll over and turn it off. Yeah. So it kept playing all night long.
I've had the same problem with 30 Rock.
Yes, we've talked about
which
that
we've talked
one.
About on the show. And my God, if you love that theme song but wish it were in a 10-second loop all night.
Yeah. So aside from that problem, I tend to watch DVDs to help me fall asleep, but it has to be something that I've already seen, preferably a lot of times. Right now I'm using Parks and Recreation. I have in the past used The Office and Friends and other things that I've seen a lot of times.
I've traditionally found that for sitcoms on DVD, The Office has been really good. It's very, very important to not have a laugh track.
Yeah.
Parks and Recreation. Mm-hmm. That to me seemed like a perfect example of a show that you can fall asleep to because it certainly has its manic moments, but it's not like like a 30 Rock that has a lot of loud music in it. Mm-hmm. You know, that Parks and Rec and Office and shows like that that have this kind of low-key, everyday, you know, here's sort of day-to-day life playing out in a funny, charming way, but in a not particularly manic way.
Right. Yeah. Both shows you mentioned don't have a laugh track. I think that makes a big deal.
That's a huge thing.
I can't do that because my husband, partner, euphemism, whatever, is...
Is
an incredibly light sleeper, so mm-hmm. I can't watch TV. And I don't have insomnia because...
I hate you.
No, because I learned long ago in my family that if you name a thing, then that makes it real. So I don't have insomnia. I just wake up every morning at 3:30 and can't get back to sleep until 6.
Isn't that the worst?
This is exactly... Okay. Thank you, because I do not have insomnia. Yeah. I have whatever that is.
Right.
And I used to have whatever that is.
My solution to that issue actually is to call it office hours.
Really? Yeah.
If it were always at the exact same time of day, I would set it as office hours and just start like a tweet up or something.
So what do you do, Glenn, in terms of trying to get back to sleep? What do you do?
Especially given that your euphemism is such a light sleeper,
right.
Do you have to then lie perfectly still? Or do you leave the room?
Here's what I don't do. I don't read fiction. Because one of the things I like about fiction is the prose, is appreciating the language, appreciating the sentence. And as you were trying to doze off is not the perfect time to appreciate that kind of stuff. And I especially can't read fiction anymore because as your dream state kicks in, it kind of takes over the characters mm-hmm. and the prose. And then you find yourself like a week later at a dinner party and everybody's talking about a visit from the goon squad and you want to pipe in. So you're like, yeah, but didn't you think that part about the frisky water polo team that kept making out with each other? That kind of came out of nowhere. Right? Or like, yeah, it was a good book, but there was a penguin that looked like my Sunday school teacher. What was that about? Where did that come from? So I can't do that. What I turned to for a while was nonfiction, short nonfiction, like your New Yorkers, your Harpers, your Atlantics. That can kind of work, although sometimes my euphemism would wake up and say, stop turning pages so loud, for example.
You should get a Kindle.
Well, that's a really good point. I would do the iPad, except I found the perfect thing right now, which is podcasts. Now, this is how I choose to go off to sleep nowadays. Now, you don't read about people waking up to somebody who has strangled themselves in the night with their headphone cords. I'm convinced they're keeping it quiet because it's got to happen.
Yeah.
And I'm convinced...
It's kind of embarrassing.
I'm convinced it's going to happen to me. Either that or I'm going to wedge an earbud into my brain deeply at some point.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's what I do. And again, because I listen to these podcasts as I fall off to sleep, is that my dreams are just the continuation of the conversation in the podcast.
You should try editing a podcast.
Oh, man. I can't even imagine.
It's a nightmare. I honestly have dreams about the things, like the conversations that I am editing.
Mm-hmm.
And
wow,
how to edit them better. It's like when you play Tetris too long, you see the blocks in your dreams.
Sure.
It's like that, but each block is like a waveform.
Are you I'm a good sleeper?
No, I'm a really bad sleeper. I do wake up quite a bit, but I've learned how to like sort of manage it by, I keep myself really busy in order to stay up later in order to then when I finally hit the pillow, it's time to go to sleep. And I actually try specifically not to do things on my bed, in my bed, unless it's for sleeping anymore.
Really? Interesting.
Like, I don't read in bed. I don't, you know, watch TV in bed. Anything like that anymore. Like, bed is, like, now just
you
for
try
sleeping.
To make that the time.
So I try to manage it a little
that's
bit.
That's
classic
advice. A lot of people will tell you that.
I'm not hard and fast on that.
So the bed is strictly for rest and for the ladies.
That's right.
For making the magic happen.
There's no way I could listen to talking voices, unless it's sort of like you said, like a sitcom-y sort of thing.
But we've ruined you for falling asleep to podcasts.
Well, I've done podcasts for a long time. I would never listen to a podcast.
When I was out at press tour and I was in the hotel, so you know, you're kind of strange environment, and I don't really have access to all the same stuff that I have at home, and some of my rituals are thrown off. I actually listened to episodes of this show when I was trying to fall asleep, and so I would like fall asleep listening to you people.
No
so
offense, I love you all, but that is the nightmare situation.
No, I know, but I never do it normally. Yeah. I never do it normally.
Yeah, that would give me so much anxiety about things that I had to do.
I know. I gather that. I know my son does, and I gather my mother will leave the iTunes, you know, thing where the shows play consecutively. Will leave it on all night.
Yeah.
I could not listen to myself.
No, I wasn't doing that. It was more like, I mean, that was a situation where I was separated from everyone that I knew, and so I was out there, and you know, so it was also like, you know, familiar people.
You missed
people.
Us.
We missed you too, Holmesy.
Possibly, but actually, the one that I discovered a couple years ago that is shockingly effective, and I share this with people who are like hardcore insomniacs, and I say, you're not going to believe me when I tell you this, but you have to try it because it's shocking how good it is.
Okay, tell me.
I play the letter game where you do the A. Oh, my name is Alice, and my husband's name is Adam, and we live in Alabama, and we
it's working.
Right? Particularly if I'm having trouble shutting down. It occupies my mind fully, but it's boring enough that I fall asleep. And in this way, it has certain similarities with some aspects of meditation. It's that good. And I almost never make it through the entire alphabet. If I make it through the entire alphabet, then I figure I'm not going to fall asleep right now, and I turn on something else to watch or something like that.
So you know what you might want to do if you wake up at 3:30 in the morning? I've found that Twitter at 3:30 a.m. Eastern Time is very, very good because that is exactly the point at which the stand-up comics on the West Coast are getting home drunk from their sets. And they're still wired. So 3:30 a.m. Eastern Time is a really active time. Just Kyle Kinane by himself can kind of keep an entire thread going.
Patton Oswalt is good for that, too.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I was also going to mention music is a really good thing, but sort of like how Linda says, you know, it's something you have to be familiar with already, because otherwise, like, you'll start sort of discovering it enough. If I listen to new music, I'm trying to sort of, like, immediately kind of analyze and start processing through it, but there's certain music that I'll definitely go to.
I have one problem with music in that the sort of traditionally peaceful, calming music that I listen to, I tend to listen to while I'm editing. So I listen to a lot of instrumental ambient music, your Stars of the Lid, your Rice Boy Sleeps, stuff like that. I love listening to, but I listen to it when I'm editing. I don't generally associate it with sleeping, and I don't necessarily want it. I don't want to associate it with dozing, or then I'll be dozing at my desk at work.
Right.
So, what do you listen to?
It's sort of just whatever I'm sort of in the mood for that, but I know is calming enough. I actually listen to
Laybach, Andrew WK.
Yeah. I was gonna say Radiohead, Kid A, and like things sort of in that realm where it's busy enough, but I wouldn't call that album soothing, but it is more so than like, you know, some of their more rock records.
Because Radiohead is sort of a soundtrack for discontent. So it's a tricky...
Yeah, but, you know, I'll go for, like, you know, some of the early Sigur Rós stuff.
Yeah.
You know, sort of how you said Rice Boy Sleeps. It's the same. You know, it's Yonzi from Sigur Rós. I don't usually listen to much, you know, indie rock or folk music because it's usually too much lyrics. You know, it's sort of like why I used to study to jazz or classical music or ambient music. It's not like to lull me to sleep. It's just to kind of
soothe your mind.
Yeah, yeah.
Have any of you used any of like the iPhone? Like, there's an iPhone app called Pizzizz, which I have downloaded but not tried.
No.
Which is like a white noise generator that a lot of people swear by.
That sounds horrifying.
I don't use that one, and I don't use white noise usually. But I had one of the alarm clocks that had a setting where you could, instead of hitting like the sleep and playing the radio for 59 minutes, like on my old clock radio as a kid, you could hit it and it would play, you know, like ocean waves or something like that. And I actually do like the ocean waves sometimes when I'm trying to fall asleep. The funniest part about it was I knew a guy who had the same clock radio, and we talked about the fact that it had a setting for like forest sounds, which was supposed to be like, you know, crickets and whatever else you're in the forest. And
apes.
The problem was it had an owl, and the owl was like only every now and then. And it wasn't that it woke you up; it was that it was really funny. It would always make me giggle. Like all of a sudden, you'd be lying in bed, you're just listening to this like nice calming, and all of a sudden, hoo hoo hoo, and I would always giggle at the owl, and so it wasn't good to fall asleep to because the owl would make me laugh.
And I wouldn't giggle at the owl. I would use the owl to mark time.
Right. Exactly.
And as you mark time, you think, boy, it's now been 5 owl cycles.
Which actually feels longer. I mean, you know, when you're sitting there, those 2 minutes feel like 2 hours,
right,
you know, or whatever.
So. Right. And I do have one for my phone. This is an Android app called Lightning Bug that has a whole bunch of different sounds you can turn off and turn on and combine them in different, you know. And some of them are like these super environmental ambient. You can get into people's heads and what helps people fall asleep by looking at what's offered on these apps. So a lot of them are like sounds like, you know, the traditional, the ocean waves, the river, the frogs, the crickets.
And these are like what people turn to for comfort, right?
Some of them are also a whole bunch of them for people who need to hear like honking cars. And if you really need like a city sound and it's too quiet and you can't sleep, you can do that too. And the ones I think are kind of the most kind of heartwarming are people who need to have like the sound of a dryer. Like the dryer running.
Is there one that makes Galaga noises? Right. That's what I would need.
But there are a bunch of these that are about like creating the feeling of an occupied house.
Right.
Like if you live by yourself. Genuinely the stuff that like maybe you remember from when you were a little kid, like hearing as you were falling asleep that the dryer would be running. You know, there's a whole set of those that are like just really sweet.
You know what I never understood? The one of those is the whale song. Because A, creepy. Creepy. Yeah. Uncanny, unsettling. B, who are you, Aquaman? How can that be comforting? It's like, oh, yes.
So do you listen to that just at work pretending you're Aquaman? Maybe I am Aquaman. I'm speaking to the whales right now.
Yep, and they are not saying anything.
Yeah. The whales are speaking back.
No, but I would prefer that, actually, too, because, you know, I have gotten chased in my dreams by my dentist who is talking like Paul F. Tompkins because I'm listening to a podcast. And actually, just recently, I swear to God this happened, I had a dream where my parents showed up and they were talking to each other about the nature of comedy, and then at one point my mom turned to my dad and said, "So we good?" Like Marc Maron.
So if you have great insomnia cures, feel free to come to our Facebook page, as Stephen mentioned, facebook.com/PCHH, and share your insomnia cures or ask for insomnia cures from the helpful PCHH community. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that they will be there for you. And that brings us to our final segment of the week. Speaking of being there for you, we are always here with what is making us happy this week. Stephen, what's making you happy this week?
Well, one thing that is making me happy this week, not to go down the well of nephews and Muppets and whatnot, but the fact that school is just around the corner, and I'm very excited about having my beloved children return to the structure to which I hope they will one day again become accustomed. Also, speaking of our beloved PCHH community on Facebook, got a lovely little note here that I thought I would pass along. This is from a Richard Pearson. It says, I was trying to find a way to reach the PCHH group. I know you specifically mentioned how much you love it when you were told what we are doing when we listen to your podcast. Well, this Friday, my fiancé, Brian Baskin, and I will be listening to it on a road trip from Hoboken, New Jersey to Watkins Glen, New York, where we will be getting married. Same-sex marriage being legalized in that state just months before the wedding we planned for a year. I know you guys don't normally do shout-outs, but I know you guys record on Tuesdays. If you felt like shouting out to us, it would make our day.
No, we're not doing that. No, I'm just kidding.
No.
Yeah. No.
Heck with you, Richard. There's no shout out for you. I just want to say to Richard and Brian, who are getting married right now, there's no shout out for you.
It would make our day that much brighter. The actual nuptials are on Saturday, August 27th, 2011. I found your podcast basically a year ago from that date, and my fiance and I discuss the podcast every weekend.
So, happy
so
wedding.
So what is making me happy is the pending nuptials of our beloved listeners, Brian and Richard.
Thank you, Brian and Richard.
And the fact,
and have a happy wedding.
The fact that our little podcast occasionally helps people sleep, I have developed a newfound appreciation of the fact that our podcast can occasionally help people sleep.
That is awesome. Glenn Weldon, what's making you happy this week?
Podcasts. I'm coming off of 2 weeks without them because 3 days into the vacation, my beloved husband of 13 years asked to borrow my iPod so he could go for a run, and he got his sweat all up in it, and it bricked. So, A, this establishes that clearly he is history's worst monster. Yeah. And B, What's worse than exercise? Nothing. Nothing. Now it destroys property. That's new. Good for that. So finally, we just got a. I just got a new iPad again, so I've been catching up on all the ones that I have been missing for the last couple weeks, going back to visit some old favorites like Film Spotting. You guys listen to Film Spotting?
Yeah, good podcast.
It's fantastic. And Judge John Hodgman, of course. But I found some new ones that I want to kind of tell folks about. Kumail Nanjiani is a stand-up comic who I like a great deal. He's on Franklin and Bash, so I'm not supporting that. But I am a big fan of him. He has a new podcast called The Indoor Kids, which is a video game podcast, and it's really entertaining. The Dork Forest is by Jackie Cation. She's a stand-up comic, and she has people on to talk about their obsessions. It's a fun show. Girl on Guy, the podcast by Aisha Tyler, doesn't need any help from me. It's already doing gangbusters, but she is, for someone who is so physically attractive, she is remarkably nerdy, and it's it seems to come from a sincere place, so that's a lot of fun. Tig Notaro is another stand-up comic I like. She is on a podcast called Professor Blastoff, but the revelation for me was one called How Was Your Week by Julie Klausner. This is a fun show. I had dismissed it unfairly early on, and I think I talked to you about this, Linda, because it seemed to evince a specific tone that a lot of, particularly gay humor can sometimes evince, because she spends a lot of time around the gay dudes, where bitchiness is meant to do the work that cleverness would do. And that just leaves me cold. I try to avoid it in my personal life. And I mistook some of that in some of her early podcasts, because it wasn't coming from her. It was coming, frankly, from some of her guests. And going back to listen to it, she's very smart. She's very funny. And she just had, ironically enough, Brian Safi, who is the guy who does the current TV show That's Gay, on. And he told a story about meeting Sharon Stone. Now, I think pretty much any story about meeting Sharon Stone is going to be pretty great. This one made my week. So if you can find it, it was a couple weeks back. It's How Was Your Week? So the thing that makes me happy is podcasts and not having to listen to my own thoughts anymore.
Outstanding.
Julie Klausner also is a very, very funny tweeter.
That's right. That's
so
true.
If you're not following Julie Klausner.
Thank you, Stephen.
Mike Katzoff, what's making you happy this week?
About 2 weeks ago, GQ published an oral history of the Dana Carvey Show, which talked to a lot of the people, Dana Carvey, Robert Smigel, who was involved, and a few other people, about the beginnings and the destined downfall of this show. So I've sort of spent the last couple weeks or so, which doesn't take much time, there's only 8 episodes, but I've been revisiting that show again. And what was sort of illuminating about this piece was that there's certain sort of legends around it about all the people that were involved and the famous sketch that they debuted with, which led to its downfall. And so some of those famous people: Robert Smigel, Louis C.K., Charlie Kaufman, Stephen Colbert, Steve Carell, Dino Stamatopoulos. That's sort of the alumni that have come out of this thing. A lot of those people nobody had ever heard of at that time. The part that was sort of interesting was it wasn't necessarily like the initial first episode, which opens with this Bill Clinton sketch where he's nursing puppies and how horrified people were. It probably was not a great decision to open with that, because of the main reason why this show was doomed from the start was that it was following Home Improvement. And I had forgotten that it followed the biggest show on television, which would have saved any show except for the fact that they were way darker, way more abstract, way sillier. And so they completely, I think, from the get-go, all these amazing people with a very different disposition, they really misjudged the audience, and it doomed it from the start.
It seriously went from, like, Wilson to nursing, to puppies.
But there's still some, actually, really outstanding sketches that...
Is it available on DVD, on Hulu?
Yes.
It is on DVD now, and it's on Hulu that everyone can revisit, so...
Yeah, and kind of see also the Ben Stiller Show, you know, which had a lot of those same people and a lot of the same sensibility, and was on Fox for reasons unknown.
And Mr. Show, I mean, obviously that got sort of 4 short seasons, but that was sort of, you know, also sort of doomed as well. But all of those early to mid-90s comedy shows planted the seeds for all the comedy that we sort of enjoy now.
They were amazing incubators for comedy. Yeah.
So that's what's making me happy, is revisiting a classic show.
Very good. What is making me happy this week is super simple. The AFI, my favorite theater in the world, on Saturday night showed Die Hard. And I saw Die Hard on the big screen on the beat-up print, where every time they change the reel, it's kind of all beat up again because the outsides of all the reels are have taken a beating over the last 23.
Did the soundtrack sort of go, as it was like flipping reels and stuff?
Yep. Yeah.
Nice.
At the very beginning, like, the thing was just a mess. Like, you looked at it and you were like, wow, this is, like, covered in scratches. But then, you know, it goes away after a couple minutes and you get into the inside of the reel that is carefully protected by the outside. I saw this movie with a very appreciative and very cooperative and non-dialogue quoting crowd.
Good.
Which I was very worried about. Big sound, giant screen. Haven't seen it that way, undoubtedly, since 1988. And so much better than the sequels that came after it.
Yeah.
And really still a completely awesome movie. Everyone who was there was having an awesome time. That movie is an absolute American classic. I will stick up for that movie against, you know, any other, despite the fact that it's a Christmas movie, any other summer movie that's basically ever been made. I think it's incredibly spectacular, especially when you see this movie and you see Rise of the Planet of the Apes in the same weekend. It's really hard to stop thinking about the kind of the pacing issues that the Ape movie has. And granted, they're not supposed to be the same movie. I'm not saying they are. But the thing that makes Die Hard awesome, I figured out while I was watching it, is that practically every frame in that movie is either setting something up or paying something off.
Mm-hmm.
And there's like none of this kind of nothing is happening, everybody's just kind of rattling around in the building. You're just like building tension. Like everything has a specific, like, why isn't he wearing shoes? Oh, this isn't why he isn't wearing shoes. You know, this lock gets broken by this, and this piece you have to put here for this thing that's going to happen later. And
well, it's a very rare economical action movie in an era.
It's
in
the really 80s, late 80s. Well,
I mean, a movie that I would compare it to for purposes of contrast, if you've ever seen The Last Action Hero, which, you know, is very widely known as a bloated catastrophe. And one of the things that makes it a bloated catastrophe is literally something like a 30-minute stretch of that movie is just there to put a key to handcuffs in this kid's hand.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's like, why you couldn't just be one of those kids who wears handcuffs on his belt loops and that's why he has a handcuff key? It was like 30 minutes of this movie, and Die Hard is a perfect example.
Yeah. It has so many little mini pieces going on that, like I said, it's always either the beginning of it or the end of it, and there are kind of these overlapping, something is always sort of escalating, or, you know, they're so smart about these big, big action sequences where everything kind of builds on itself and you get to these parts where you're on the roof and it's going to blow up and you're getting shot at. You know, so that's how he gets into this the famous sequence where he ties the fire hose around himself and jumps off the edge of the building. And then has to figure out how to get into the building from the outside through the window, and then has to figure out how to have the fire hose thing not drag him back down out the window. And it just goes and goes and goes and has this wonderful engine of momentum. And I just absolutely loved it and had a great time. And it is making me more than happy this week. So
you
definitely
haven't mentioned Rickman. How'd you get through it all without mentioning Rickman? Not
even
once.
He's fantastic. He's fantastic. I didn't mention really Willis either. I didn't really talk about any of the people. But yeah, everybody in it is.
What about Bonnie Bedelia?
She's wonderful. In it. Everybody is good in it.
Her heart is like a wheel.
No, Rickman is a wonderful, wonderful villain, and you kind of want him to, you know, as I think everybody has said about this movie, you kind of cheer for him to die at the end, but you also can kind of cheer for him when they open the vault, and, you know, you feel a little bit of like, oh, you know, like, rah, oh wait, you know, he's the bad guy, but still, you kind of want him to do well, right? No, he's fantastic. It's a great relationship between the two of them. It's a great relationship between him and the cop. It all works. It all hangs together. And parts of it are very funny sort of takedowns of that kind of mid-80s mergers and acquisitions, big office party culture, and the pre-sexual harassment lawsuit office party culture, all that stuff. So it was fun. It was great, great, great fun. And I recommend it to anyone. If you ever get a chance to see that movie on the big screen, go do it. So that brings us to the end of our show. And you can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me and the blog at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen. That's S-D-E-P-H-E-N. You can follow Glenn at G-H Weldon. That's W-E-L-D-O-N. You can follow our esteemed producer, Mike Katziff, and ask him questions about content or producing our wonderful show at Mike Katziff. That's K-A-T-Z-I-F. You can follow the absent Trey Graham, who we miss so much, at Trey with an E and Graham like the cracker. And you can also, as we've mentioned several times, find us on Facebook. We will look forward to seeing you there or seeing you on the blog at Monkey C. Thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you next week.